and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, April the 9th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Family Center Eyes New Direction. Director Antonio Muzan hopes the Dubuque facility can continue to be a place where people feel at home. It's written by Andy Piper of the Telegraph Herald. One of the roles of Dubuque's Multicultural Family Center is to create a place for people to feel safe and comfortable regardless of their identity. Director Antonio Muzan has a goal of building an identity for the MFC itself. Muzan shared a story with Dubuque City Council members during a recent fiscal year 2025 budget hearing that he believes illustrates what the center's work is all about. A group of leaders and delegates from Kosovo was visiting Iowa and planned to visit the center. Kosovo is an independent country that is not officially recognized by all other countries around the globe. As the delegates toured the MFC, Muzan suddenly heard a commotion. "My head turned and I go into our main space," Muzan said. "All of the leaders and delegates are pointing at their flag being represented on our wall. The joy, the celebration, the happiness that was in that moment, I can't even speak into words. Upon learning that you can write on the walls of the MFC, one of the delegates wrote, 'Thank you for making us feel at home and represented.' For me, that speaks to the identity of what the MFC is," Muzan said. "For so many in our community, it is a place where people feel at home. They feel safe. They feel valued. They feel honored and celebrated. That's what we get to do at the Multicultural Family Center." Muzan has spent his first 9 months in the position working with the board of directors to set the direction of the facility for years to come. Board member Marlene Wohler said Muzan has been making a difference. "He has been with us since July, and we have seen the numbers go up, up, up," Wohler said. "The engagement of staff with people coming into our center and bringing them back to our adult programs is just so refreshing. For the board, we weren't having active committees. Now we are engaged and very active, reaching out into the community for people who maybe aren't ready to join the board, but who might want to join a committee. I can't say enough about the spirit he has brought back to us." As the strategic planning process continues, Muzan said there are three areas of focus: cultural and identity celebrations, adult programming, and youth program. The center organized several events around cultural identity. "The goal is to create spaces for people to celebrate, honor, and educate about the diversity within the community. The three-day Juneteenth event brought over 900 people last year," Muzan said. "The Dubuque Pride Festival brought 850 people to downtown." Council member Danny Sprank said he is involved with organizing the Pride event and shared some of the feedback he has heard from attendees. "A lot of folks, when talking about it these last few years, is one, that the city has an event, and two, that it is so welcoming and inclusive," Sprank said. "Folks have gotten to see a part of our community in a positive light, and they want to see these events continue." Muzan highlighted some of these successes with the adult programs focusing on upward mobility, such as the Employment and Empowerment Expo that puts individuals in contact with business professionals to work on job readiness, resumes, and interview skills, and offers an opportunity to have a professional headshot taken. "I know people say education is power, but I would like to add that access to education is power," Muzan said. "When we bring resources to the space and have underrepresented communities who are asking questions about home ownership and making meaning and sense of it in their own lives, it's exciting to see." Teen programming includes hangouts, teen nights, tutoring, and a book club. Field trips are designed to broaden the life experiences of participants who might otherwise never take the opportunity to attend an event. One of those trips was to a Fighting Saints hockey game where many of the 36 teens who attended had never been to a game. Neither had Muzan. "I remember sitting in the back and one teen said, 'This is the best field trip we've had in a long time,'" Muzan said. "And she was yelling, 'Hockey games, you can yell at the top of your lungs and the energy is amazing.'" The Summer Teen Empowerment Program is a 6-week program that focuses on leadership development. Graduates receive high school credit for attending and tackling subjects such as social-emotional learning, financial literacy, employability, and community service. Research shows that when people get involved in contributing to their community and finding their purpose, they are more likely to be successful, Muzan said. Councilmember David Resnick said it has been disturbing to him over the past few years that diversity, equity, and inclusion somehow have gotten a bad name. It's a zero-sum game that if one group is winning, another group loses, Resnick said. Actually, what you are proving at the MFC is that when a group is winning, we are all winning as a society. We're inspired by what you are doing, and I just say more, please. Councilmember Susan Farber discussed staffing, and Muzan said he is working with the board to develop a solid plan before addressing that issue. I want to make sure we are making sound, informed decisions about staffing, Muzan said. Now that I have been here 9 months, I would definitely say we need more resources to support our events. Council members agreed to discuss the issue at their goal-setting sessions in August. Next is an article entitled, Sun Spectators Revel in Eclipse. Local sites host gatherings to watch rare celestial event. It's written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. The dateline is Maquoketa, Iowa. Seated outside Hertzville Interpretive Center near Maquoketa on Monday afternoon, Frank Goodnow held up a cardboard box in front of his great-granddaughter, Ava Brown. The five-year-old stood with her back to the sun and placed her eye to a hole in the box, looking at the piece of white paper inside it that was designed to reflect the sun's image through a pinhole. See that? That's the moon covering up the sun, Frank told Ava. Pretty soon, most of that white dot will be gone. Frank and his wife, Jane, brought Ava to see Monday's solar eclipse at the center, where Jackson County Conservation hosted an eclipse viewing party that drew about 120 people. It's a cool natural phenomenon, so this is a way for people to come and enjoy it together, said Jackson County Conservation Environmental Education Coordinator Jessica Wagner. We're glad to see folks interested in this kind of scientific experience. An eclipse occurs when the moon passes between the sun and the earth, blocking out the sun's light. An eclipse can be partial or total and is only visible from a limited region of earth. Although Monday's event was a total eclipse, the tri-state area was not in the path of totality, meaning local viewers saw only a partial eclipse. Still, many communities, schools, libraries, and other organizations hosted watch parties and other viewing programs in honor of the occasion. In Maquoketa, Green Iowa AmeriCorps members serving with Jackson County Conservation helped coordinate the event, where attendees could complete eclipse-themed craft and activities such as the viewing box Ava Brown was using. Volunteers also distributed free eclipse glasses for safe viewing of the sun during the event. According to Green Iowa AmeriCorps member Shelby Davison, Cybesma Eye and Vision Center in Maquoketa donated about 100 pairs of the glasses for the event. About 30 minutes before the eclipse's peak in Maquoketa at about 2 p.m., Davison showed viewers how to track its progress by holding a colander over a piece of white paper on the ground and looking at the shadows of the colander holes. The reflection of the circular holes will get to be less and less of a perfect circle because there's only so much light coming through, she said, pointing out the small indentations that had already started to emerge in the shadowy holes. Rural Maquoketa resident Amanda Horschelman said her daughters Emma, Autumn, and Ava staked out their viewing spots at a small picnic. Emma said she was excited to see the eclipse, especially because she would have to wait a long time for the next one. Ava and Autumn said it won't happen again for 20 more years, she said. According to NASA, the next total solar eclipse visible from anywhere in the contiguous U.S. will not occur until August the 23rd of 2044. Reese Saunders of Eldridge brought his daughter, Malika, 8, and Alaya to view the eclipse. Just before 2 p.m., Reese and Malika were busily taking bites out of Oreo cookies in an attempt to create the shape of the eclipse in edible form. It's really cool, but it's going to be pretty weird because when it goes dark, it's like everything turns off, Malika said. Alaya said she saw the most recent eclipse in 2017, the first total solar eclipse visible across the U.S. since 1979, but she doesn't remember much of it. I know we're not going to get total darkness, but I still thought it would be cool to see this one, she said. At its peak in Maquoketa, the eclipse covered about 88% of the sun, according to NASA. For several minutes around 2 p.m., the sunlight dimmed slightly. Many eyes turned upward while others peered through viewing boxes or held up the colanders to view their shadows, noting how the circular holes looked like half moons. Mark and Lisa Hammer of Maquoketa sat side by side in lawn chairs, quietly taking in the sight. The Hammers have experienced previous solar eclipses and said they were glad to see the large crowd that gathered from Mondays. We have a great community feel here with other people that are also science nerds coming out to view the same thing, Lisa said. And in our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today, couple opening event space in Cable Car Square. Dubuque Dermatology Office to begin serving patients. Farm-to-table store opens in Cascade. Written by Grace Neeland of the Telegraph Herald. A new event venue is opening in a former boutique space in Dubuque's Cable Car Square. The Story space recently opened at 345 Bluff Street, the former home of the boutique Fig Leaf. The customizable space is available for hourly and daily event rentals for small and medium-sized gatherings. We want people to be able to tell their own stories here, said owner Rylan McQuillan. It's fun. It's whimsical, and we're really hoping people will enjoy it as much as we do. McQuillan and her husband Jeff own the Bluff Street building and previously ran it as Fig Leaf. The boutique closed earlier this year after declining sales, the pair attributed to a continued rise in online shopping. With the boutique behind them, the McQuillans were faced with a choice about what to do next. At first, Jeff McQuillan said they considered renting it out for photography sessions, but the more the pair talked about it with friends and family, the more they heard about the need for smaller event spaces more broadly. We were looking for a new venture, he said. We were talking with Rylan's mom, and she said, you could really use this space for a multitude of events, and it just clicked. Few structural changes were needed, Jeff added, but various eye-catching displays and decorations have been added to bolster visual appeal and intrigue. Those displays will rotate seasonally for different events or holidays. The pair envisioned the space being used for anything from bridal showers or kids' birthday parties to a local pop-up shop or business retreat. Maximum capacity still is being finalized, but the space is targeted towards small to medium-sized groups. We want it to be a very comfortable space, Rylan said. So many people loved Fig Leaf and loved this space, and this is kind of a full circle way so that we can still have people in here and still be helping the community. The Story Space can be booked online at thestoryspace.as.me. Additional questions can be directed to bookthestoryspace@gmail.com or by calling area code 563-513-9718. New Dubuque Dermatology Office nears opening. A new dermatology office is set to debut in Dubuque. Driftless Skin Center is set to open Monday, April 15th at 1550 University Avenue, Suite B, near Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital. The center offers screenings and treatment for a variety of dermatological concerns, including acne, warts, rosacea, and skin cancer. The office will be led by physician's assistant Megan Eisel. Eisel has worked in dermatology for 20 years, 13 of which were spent working at Dubuque's Grand River Medical Group. I'm looking forward to seeing my patients someplace with a fresh new look, Eisel said of the new office. I was driven to do something on my own and give back to the community in my own way. Driftless Skin Center is equipped with 3 patient exam rooms as well as a large reception and waiting area. In addition to Eisel, the office is staffed by a registered nurse, medical assistant, office manager, and receptionist. Eisel said the office was laid out to curate a welcoming environment in a modern, clean space. Skin health is for everyone, and we're here to help, Eisel said. Ironically, the skin is the largest organ, but it is sometimes forgotten about as a part of the body we need to take care of if we want to be happy and healthy. Starting next week, Driftless Skin Center will be open 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday. More information and online booking is available at driftlessskin.com or patients can call the office at area code 563-900-8922. Farm to Table store opens in Cascade. A new retail space has opened in Cascade with a focus on connecting consumers with area farmers. The Behringer Family Farms store recently opened at 28031 Goose Hill Road. All of the items in the store are sourced from the Behringer Farm or from producers operating within a 30-mile radius. The store is kind of a one-stop shop farmers market, said owner Lily Behringer. We're offering fresh beef, pork, and chicken, as well as a lot of dairy products, eggs, and fresh greens. In addition to staples such as eggs and milk, the store also sells locally sourced baked goods, lotions, candles, and more. Items will rotate regularly to stock whatever is fresh and in season. The farm store is located on the Behringer Family Farm rather than at a typical storefront to encourage customers to become familiar with agricultural landscapes and ask any questions they might have, Behringer said. The goal is to increase the quality and quantity of connections area residents have to the producers who grow and make their food products. The gap between the farmer and the consumer seems to be growing further and further, Behringer said. I think it's important that we help people get connected to the source so they can talk to somebody they trust and ask any questions they might have. Behringer added that the store is just one of the ways the Behringer family hopes to achieve that goal. Moving forward, she would like to add opportunities for agricultural programming and agritourism at the farm, too. Some of those opportunities would be aimed at area youth, while others would be open to all ages. Our main goal is to connect consumers with farmers and show the whole process of how you get food onto your table, Behringer said. The farm store is the first step of having that kind of full-circle programming. The Behringer Family Farms store is open from 2 to 6 p.m. Friday and 9 to 1 p.m. Sunday. Weekly updates about what is in stock can be found online at facebook.com/Behringer Farm. Behringer Family Farms, and Behringer is spelled B-E-R-I-N-G-E-R. Or by subscribing to the Behringer Family Farms newsletter at BehringerFamilyFarms.com. On the Dubuque and Tri-State page, we have an article entitled, Local Care Facility Will Offer Program to Aid Dementia Patients' Caregivers. The program aims to help keep older adults in their homes and out of emergency rooms and hospitals. This is written by Maia Bond of the Telegraph Herald. A Dubuque care facility soon will offer more robust care for area residents with dementia. Stonehill Communities announced Monday that it has been selected to participate in a new U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services program called the Guide and Improved Dementia Experience Model. Stonehill will start admitting participants to the program in July 2025 and provide case management support to dementia patients in the community. GUIDE is an 8-year program offered nationwide to individuals with dementia diagnosis who are enrolled in Medicare's Part A and B and are not living in a long-term care setting, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Peggy Stockel, president and CEO of Stonehill Communities, said the program builds upon the services Stonehill's Caregiver Resource Center already provides. In the program, an interdisciplinary team provides case management, education, support, and resources for dementia patients and their caregivers as the disease progresses, with the ultimate goal of keeping patients in their homes for as long as possible. We will meet with caregivers and their loved ones who have dementia, and when we're meeting with them, the goal is really to walk alongside them in their journey, Stockel said. Stockel said the team will create a person-centered care plan and address caregiver needs, including 24/7 access to a support professional. She said as the population of Iowans age 65 or older increases, GUIDE will help keep older adults in their homes and out of emergency rooms, hospitals, and long-term care facilities. Stockel said Stonehill officials soon will learn if they will be awarded federal funds to kickstart the program. Stonehill also will receive a monthly stipend to administer the program, though the amount will vary depending on patient circumstances, she said. Jolene Koopman, coordinator of the Caregiver Resource Center, said she is excited to use the program to improve the quality of life for those with dementia and those helping care for dementia patients. She said the Resource Center already provides education and support for caregivers, but this program will focus on those with dementia on top of the current resources available to all caregivers. Though the start date is over a year away, Koopman said she already has received inquiries from individuals hoping to participate in the program. Amy Schauer, Stonehill Community's Executive Director of Development, said the offering will build on Stonehill's legacy. "We're always looking to serve the next need in the community and being able to serve those with dementia and their caregivers in their home or community-based setting was really a good way to expand that and meet the expanded need of people wanting to stay in their own homes longer," she said. To be eligible to facilitate the program, Stonehill had to be enrolled in Medicare Part B, meet the care delivery requirements, and maintain staff for the care team, according to a statement from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The statement said a list of all provider participants likely will be released this summer. Next up, Dubuque School Board approves budget, including decreased tax levy rate. Nearly $180 million budget funds school operations for fiscal 2025 beginning July 1st. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. Dubuque Community Schools officials are decreasing the district's tax levy rate for the coming fiscal year, and homeowners should see a decrease in their school district portion of their property taxes. School board members on Monday voted unanimously to approve a $179.7 million certified budget for the fiscal year that starts July 1st. As part of that budget, the district's property tax rate will be set at an estimated $13.01 per $1,000 of taxable valuation, a decrease of about $1.50 from the district's current tax levy rate of $14.51 per $1,000 of tax valuation. At the meeting, Chief Financial Officer Kevin Kelleher reminded board members that when the current levy rate was approved last April, the district was preparing for an up to $150 million general obligation bond referendum to pay for a new middle school and other district projects. Voters narrowly rejected the bond in November. That rate would have carried forward far into the future if the bond passed, Kelleher said. Because the bond didn't pass, we've declined the levy rate about $1.50 because that bond piece was about $1.50 of the levy rate. That's why we said we had some flexibility back then. We knew a couple other different pieces of the levy were going to go down, and that's what you see is happening for this year. Kelleher also noted that the $13.01 rate might be slightly higher than what taxpayers ultimately see on the district portion of their property tax bills. A new state law required districts to hold multiple public hearings on the proposed levy rate and publish it earlier than in previous years, but the Iowa legislature did not set a key piece of districts' budgets, state per pupil funding for public schools, until late last month. Because districts were required to publish budgets and estimated tax levies before lawmakers set per-pupil funding, the rates the district published in mid-March and again on Monday were the best estimates Kelleher and his staff could make at the time. He said the Iowa Department of Management will review district levy rates in the coming months and adjust them as needed before the county auditor sends out the finalized rate to all taxpayers. State law dictates that the final levy rate can be no higher than the first published proposed rate, so the rate will not increase from the $13.01 discussed Monday, but could decrease. Based on the $13.01 rate in the city of Dubuque, the owner of an average valued home, $159,503, will pay $80.65 less in school taxes annually. Owners of industrial properties will see the school district portion of their property taxes decline by 7.1%, or $503.59 annually for an average valued property. Commercial property owners, meanwhile, will see a 12.2% increase in the district portion of their property taxes, or a $596.88 annually for an average valued property due to overall increases in assessed valuation. After the meeting, Board President Kate Parks said many factors that make up the levy rate are outside of the district's control. As enrollment falls and state aid does not keep pace with inflation, the district's spending authority falls, meaning the tax levy rate falls too. "It's disappointing that our levy rate is where it is," she said. "That's not because I want our taxpayers to be paying a ton of tax dollars, but because it means we'll be able to provide less resources for the kids." Now it's time to turn today's opinion page, and we've got another view entitled to More Than 20% Tip or Just Entitlement Mentality. It's written by Christine Flowers, who is an attorney and a columnist for the Delaware County, Pennsylvania Daily Times, and can be reached at cflowers1961@gmail.com. The other night, I took a friend out for her birthday to an upscale French restaurant. The food is magnificent, as authentic as anything I tasted when I lived in Paris. Cue the accordion music. But even perfection has its ticks. Normally, service at this restaurant is sublime. But this night, I had a problem. After having a wonderful meal and then calculating a respectable tip of 20% on a pretty expensive bill, since the service was okay but not exceptional, I gave the waiter the money. He disappeared. Later on, while I was finishing my coffee, I noticed him glaring at me as he was flitting around the tables nearby. Normally, I leave a tip between 30 and 40% because I used to work in a fast food joint and I know that it isn't exactly easy work. However, I am also aware that nobody is owed a tip and that it's not my fault if the employer isn't paying a decent salary. Just because I want to enjoy a nice salad doesn't mean I'm required to adopt the guy who brings it to my table. So the glaring and then the lack of a thank you for the tip was a little unnerving. Then I did what I normally do whenever I have an experience that can fit into a couple short sentences. I hopped onto Twitter. Surprisingly, my complaint got a lot of likes, which goes to show you I'm not the only one who has had to deal with an ungrateful little whippersnapper. Of course, there were a bunch of current or former waitstaff who weighed in, calling me entitled, saying 20% was a pittance. As I said before, I often tip up to 50% of the meal if the person serving it to me shows that they really appreciated my presence, albeit temporary, in their lives. If they made me feel as if it wasn't a burden to serve me and their name was not Job, it's my default position to show gratitude with extra cash. But the suggestion that a tip is owed, not earned, and the refusal to extend a simple thank you is a troubling commentary on something that has more to do with character than carbohydrates. I'm tired of people assuming they have rights and privileges regardless of their own conduct. It's not like I want a stranger to write me into her will if I hold the door open or let them go ahead of me in line. Those are the normal reflexes of people who live in a civilized society. I'm talking about the idea that if you extend yourself beyond what is expected in a particular social situation, that should be rewarded by the most valuable and least expensive of things, a smile and acknowledgement. Waiters and waitresses have a hard job, but so do police officers, doctors, construction workers, and even immigration lawyers. Last time I checked, no one was leaving money in a tip jar for me. The assumption that even the most mediocre service deserves some kind of financial premium is wrong. Sorry, but all of those kids who were raised by mommy and daddy to believe that they were special have morphed into presumptuous ingrates. That breadbasket you just put on my table is not going to cure cancer. That being said, I'm still going to tip in a grandiose and generous manner when the person who is on the other side of the money acknowledges my humanity. There are a lot of young people who make my lattes, mix my Aperol spritzes, and slice my pizza into exactly the correct size of slices who deserve not only a tip, but my genuine gratitude for their genuine kindness. As for those who think I owe them, this Karen, or Mademoiselle Karine, as the case may be, has better use for her hard-earned dough. And again, that was written by Christine Flowers, who is an attorney and a columnist for the Delaware County, Pennsylvania Daily Times. You're listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now it's time to turn to today's obituaries. And first, we remember Wilford J. Rundy, of age 94, of East Dubuque, Illinois, who passed away on Friday, April the 5th, at Harmony Nursing Home in Dubuque. He was a 1943 graduate of St. Mary's, a 1947 graduate of Loras Academy, and a 1951 graduate of Loras College. Took a year off from his coaching duties at East Dubuque High School to earn an MA degree from Catholic University through Loras College in 1965. After spending 51 through 52 getting a minor in PE at UW-Platteville, Will taught and coached at Baldwin, Iowa during the 52 through 53 and 53 through 54. The next 2 years, 1954 to 1955 and 1955 to 1956, Will taught and coached at Goose Lake, Iowa. In the fall of 1957, Will moved back to his hometown where he taught and coached until 1992 at East Dubuque High School. Will played baseball and softball on some area teams, most notably on baseball teams ably managed by Jerry Vossen and Gene Acola. Will had a lifelong interest in H.O. Gage model railroading, which began with a train on an oval track from Santa Claus. It culminated with a basement layout, which was constructed beginning in 1992. A few years later, an addition was built. A Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque with Father Dennis Vargas officiating. Burial will be in the East Dubuque Cemetery. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. Next, we remember Curtis R. Adams, age 63, of Cibola, who died on Thursday, April the 4th, 2024. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Wednesday, April the 10th at Calvary Lutheran Church in Cibola, where services will follow. Burial will be in Evergreen Cemetery in Cibola. Next, we remember May C. Dement, age 87, of Dubuque, who died on Sunday, April the 7th, 2024. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April the 11th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April the 12th, at Church of the Nativity. Now we remember Brooke Anderson, age 29, of Asbury, who died Friday, April the 5th, 2024. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday, April the 11th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. Now we remember James L. Klusner, age 86, of Dubuque, who passed away on Friday, April the 5th, 2024, at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, April the 10th, 2024, at the Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home, 2659 Kennedy Road, with a parish wake service at 6 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be held Thursday, April the 11th, 2024, at 10:30 a.m. at the Church of the Resurrection. Burial will be in the Resurrection Cemetery with military honors accorded by the American Legion Post No. 6 of Dubuque. James was born in Strawberry Point, Iowa. He's a 1955 graduate of Holy Cross High School in Holy Cross, Iowa. He served in the U.S. Army from 1961 to his honorable discharge in 1964. He was united in marriage to Judy Clemen on October the 12th, 1968, in Fairley, Iowa. She was his loving partner, and they shared a wonderful life together. And together they welcomed two children, Amy and Andrew. Over his working career, Jim had many sales jobs. These ranged from selling cigarettes, Keebler products, farm service products, and ultimately insurance and investment products. Jim was a licensed broker and insurance and investment advisor. He co-owned and operated Health Advisors, an insurance and investment business, until his retirement. His office was located downtown in the Fisher Building, and he enjoyed meeting up at Mario's with his friends for lunch during the work week. Jim had a very strong Catholic faith. He said his prayers morning and night, attended daily Mass until his health declined, and received the sacraments regularly and had a strong devotion to the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. While in good health, he made a weekly holy hour with Jesus at the Power of Prayer Adoration Chapel. He loved the rosary, EWTN, and his religious medals. James was active in many religious organizations over the years. He was a longtime member of the Church of the Resurrection for 20 years. He was involved in the parish council at St. Anthony Church, a member of St. Vincent de Paul Society, a fourth degree member of the Knights of Columbus, Sarah Club, Kiwanis, and an associate with the Sisters of the Presentation. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to Right to Life, Hospice of Dubuque, and St. Vincent de Paul Society. Next, we remember William D. Bill Bartles, age 66, of Platteville, Wisconsin, who passed away peacefully, surrounded by family, on March 20, 2024. Bill was born January 19, 1958, in Platteville, Wisconsin. He was united in marriage to Catherine Rikers on March 31, 2012, at their house in Platteville. He attended Platteville High School, where he lettered as a multi-sport athlete. After high school, he received his Master's of Plumbing from SWTC. Bill enjoyed fishing, where he participated in walleye tournaments, singing, playing guitar, tending to his flower gardening, and playing cards at the barge. He was an avid Wisconsin team sports fan of the Badgers, Packers, Brewers, and Bucks. He had a great sense of humor, which his family and friends are truly going to miss. A celebration of life will be held on Sunday, April the 14th, 2024, from 2 to 5 p.m. at the VFW Platteville. The Melby Funeral Home and Crematory Platteville is serving the family. Online condolences can be made at www.melbyfh.com. Now we remember Thomas A. Schroeder, M.D., a loving father, grandfather, physician, volunteer, and friend, died peacefully in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, on March 31st, 2024, at the age of 90. Please see Pagan Kopf Funeral Home website for full obituary, www.pagankopf.com, and that's spelled P-A-G-E-N-K-O-P-F. Services will be held at Pagan Kopf Funeral Home, 2228 North Silver Maple Lane, Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, on Friday, April the 12th, 2024. Visitation will be held at 9 a.m. with a Catholic service to follow at 11 a.m. Guests are invited to stay for a celebration lunch. Interment at St. Jerome Cemetery will follow. Now we remember Lorraine F. Heffel, age 97, of North Buena Vista, Iowa, who passed away Saturday, April the 6th, at her home surrounded by her loving family. Visitation will be held from 2 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 11th, at Immaculate Conception Hall in North Buena Vista. Visitation will continue Friday at the IC Hall, beginning at 9 a.m. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, April the 12th, 2024, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Marvin Breeze will officiate. Lorraine was born June 22, 1926, in Beaulieu, Minnesota. She married Charles Heffel on October the 6th, 1952, in Beaulieu, Minnesota. Together they farmed the family farm until retirement in 1997. Lorraine enjoyed traveling and shopping with family and friends. She loved crocheting. She had given the children and family many crocheted tablecloths over the years. She enjoyed spending time with the church ladies. She gardened, harvested produce, and cooked many delicious meals for her family, especially baking. She cherished the Christmas memories with her family and baked Christmas cookies. Kramer Funeral Home in Holy Cross is assisting the family, and information is available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Street Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 5204. And we remember Mary R. Johnson, age 93, of Dubuque, who died on Saturday, April the 6th, 2024. A rosary will be recited at 9 a.m. Saturday, April the 13th, followed by visitation until 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, where services will follow. Interment will be held at 2:30 p.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery in Fillmore. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home of Dubuque is assisting the family. Now we'll turn to sports, and the top story on the sports page is entitled Clark Redefines Game While Turning Iowa into a Winner. It's written by Will Graves of the Associated Press. Dateline is Cleveland, Ohio. Caitlin Clark doesn't want to think about it, or doesn't want to talk about it. That will come later, probably much later. Yes, the Iowa star sees the packed stands, hears the pop in the crowd whenever she drops in another three-pointer from the logo, senses the throngs of media around her, doesn't need to be reminded that her name has been trending pretty much everywhere over 4 months that have transformed her life and, in some ways, her sport. The reality is the leading all-time scorer in NCAA Division I history envisioned some of this. A year ago, after a painful loss to LSU in the national title game, Clark's lone focus was finding a way back. One paradigm-shifting season later, that moment arrived Sunday. And while it ended just the same way last year's final against LSU did, with Clark and the Hawkeyes walking off the floor amid confetti that fell for others as South Carolina celebrated its second title in 3 years, she tried to keep it in perspective. Yes, she wanted to win. Badly. And she played like it, particularly during a first quarter in which she poured in 18 points, a record for most points in a quarter in an NCAA final. Yet the deep and relentless Gamecocks wore Clark and the Hawkeyes down. She finished with 30 in all before checking out with 20 seconds to go, receiving a long, loud ovation and a hug from Coach Lisa Bluder. There were no tears. Not publicly, anyway. Instead, there was an appreciation for a remarkable journey few deemed possible when she arrived on campus 4 years ago. The emotions will probably hit me over the next couple of days, Clark said. I don't have much time to sit around and sulk and be upset. I don't think that's what I'm about, either. Yeah, I'm sad we lost this game, but I'm also so proud of myself. I'm so proud of my teammates. I'm so proud of this program, and there's a lot to be proud of. The evidence of how far Clark and women's college basketball have come has been everywhere over the last month, nowhere more than at a Final Four laden with star power both on the court and in the stands. The arena was nearly full when Clark's now iconic number 22 made its way onto the floor for Iowa's open practice on Saturday. Jogging out to meet her teammates in a black jersey, shorts, and socks, she casually sank a three-pointer from the wing the first time she touched the ball, a splash through the net that was met with an audible volume spike. It was that way over the course of 50 mostly informal minutes. The cameras in the arena never wandered too far. The crowd never really went silent. It never really does when Clark is involved. It's been that way for a while now. She has navigated it all with an uncommon polish, welcoming the spotlight if only because it gives her the power to point it in whatever direction she chooses. Clark doesn't view herself as one of one, but a part of a burgeoning ecosystem with women within women's sports. Sure, a record 14.2 million tuned in to watch Iowa's win over UConn on Friday night. She doesn't view it as a one-off. I think you see it across the board, whether it's softball, whether it's gymnastics, volleyball, Clark said. People want to watch. It's just when they're given the opportunity, the research and the facts show that people love it. And they love Clark in particular, a full circle moment for Clark she never saw coming. As a kid, she remembers being part of the Jimmer mania that surrounded former BYU sharpshooter Jimmer Fredette. Now, she's one with the kids in the stands wearing T-shirts in her likeness. She's the one who has created a fight fiefdom of sorts, selling out basketball games wherever she laces up her black and yellow Nikes. It's all a bit strange, if only because this was never her intention. Growing up, she dreamed of helping Iowa chase down the women's basketball powers that be. Now she and the Hawkeyes have elbowed their way among the sport's elite. That was always the goal. Not all that has surprisingly come with it. The commercials, the name drops from hoops royalty like LeBron James and Steph Curry, and the way she's helped make women's basketball accessible to an audience that long considered it an afterthought, if it considered it at all. It can be dizzying. She has tried, however, to keep it in perspective, stressing whenever she can that this thing, whatever it is hardly just about her. It's about those who came before her and those who will come after her. It's a group that is rapidly expanding. As Clark and the Hawkeyes went through a walkthrough that doubled as a celebration for how far they've come, a young girl held a sign that said, "I used to play soccer, now I hoop." She's hardly alone. I genuinely believe every time that Caitlin breaks a record or comes off a game, there are thousands of boys and girls out shooting and wanting to be 22, Iowa coach Lisa Bluder said. Thousands. The original is ready to cede the stage, or at least at this level, to others. It's a moment Clark knows is coming, even though she's made it a point to not get ahead of herself. Getting too caught up in the lastness of everything would take too much energy from the task at hand. "I know what's next is soon," she said Sunday, "but at the same time, I'm not blind to the fact that I need to enjoy this. I need to soak this in." The WNBA draft, where Clark is expected to be taken first overall by the Indiana Fever, awaits on April the 15th, little more than a week away. Then maybe some time with Team USA before the Paris Olympics. It's been a whirlwind. It will be a whirlwind. There will be time to reflect down the road. Sunday marked the end of one part of her life. Next week begins the start of another. She's hopeful the people that made their way into the tent stick around for what's to come. "I don't really get offended when people say I never watched women's basketball before," she said. "I think, one, you're a little late to the party, yes. But two, that's cool. We're changing the game. We're attracting more people to it." People that watched to root for her, people that watched to root against her, people that watched out of curiosity, people that watched out of wonder. Clark doesn't really care how or why they came along for the ride. It simply matters that they did. And that means more than any net-cutting ceremony ever could. The way people are not only showing up, but cheering about the game and invested in the game, they understand the game, she said. They know what's going on. They're passionate about it. To me, that's the coolest thing. That's the Caitlin Clark thing. In boys prep track and field, Bobcats eye team gold. WD returns wealth of talent from last year's second place state team. This is written by Danny Miller of the Telegraph Herald. Western Dubuque remained in contention for a Class 3A team title well into the final day of last year's Iowa State Track and Field Championships, but settled for runner-up. With many of those same athletes back on the track in 2024, the Bobcats have high hopes of bringing back a first-place trophy from Des Moines. Dubuque Hempstead, Dubuque Senior, and Dubuque Wallert won't feature as many state veterans, but continue to grow in numbers and expect to make some noise this fall. Here's a capsule preview of the four Dubuque area schools competing in the Mississippi Valley Conference this season. First, Dubuque Hempstead. Head coach Mark Ressler is in his seventh season. Returning veterans are John Maloney, Zach Johnson, Charlie Driscoll, Micah Fern, Matt Hanselman, Owen Lightson, Brandon Koss, Landon McKay, Avery Keener, Kyle Dewar, Christian Pettinger, Tate Woodruff, James Eichhorn, Thomas Bradshaw, and Jordan Plummer. Maloney and Iowa State meet veteran returns after a pair of fifth-place finishes last year in the 4A 1600 and 3200. This year, he figures to be one of the top distance runners in the state. Fern, Johnson, and Driscoll ran as part of the state qualifying 4x800 team that placed 15th at state. The Mustangs continue to grow in numbers with 91 athletes out this year. The increased roster will provide depth and balance to an already strong distance unit. Dubuque senior head coach is Ryan Giesman in his eighth season. Returning veterans include Jaden Arnold, Nick Lambie, TJ Lynn, Dylan Thule, Zach Hare, Jacob Hogg, Finn Kincaid, Calvin Lucan, Dalen Moore, Garrett Schumacher, Charlie Crow, Tevin Schultz, Ben Homan, Ben Davis, Noah Rowling, Andrew Thiessen, Tanner Tompkins, Marshawn Dukes, and Isaac Gooch. The outlook for the Rams is the Rams bring back Lambie and Arnold, both of whom competed in multiple events in last year's state meet. Lambie competed individually in the 4A 100 and ran as part of the state qualifying sprint medley 4x100 and 4x200. Arnold ran the anchor leg of the 4x4, 4x2, and sprint medley. Thule and Crow also returned with state experience from last year. Senior has strong leadership from its upperclassmen, but will also rely on a heavy dose of underclassmen to reload in many areas. Dubuque Wallard is led by head coach Bob Oberfell. He's in his fifth season. Returning veterans include Tom Scher, William Grommet, Pierce Oberfell, Ryder Valley, Isaac Lee, Jaden Brookins, Brevin Hawkinson, Eden Schrack, Nick Klapatosikas, Drew Riley, Greg Smith, and Anderson Herbst. The outlook for the Dubuque Wallard squad is that Scher competed as part of the Golden Eagles' 14th place 4x200 squad last year and is the lone returning state participant from a Wallard team that placed 12th in the 3A team competition. A wealth of young talent combined with a core veteran group that has eyes on reaching state should have the Golden Eagles trending in the right direction come May. And Western Dubuque head coach Tom Jaspers in his 15th year. Returning veterans include Tyler Horstman, Ryan Digman, Brock Carpenter, Brandon Decker, Dylan Allwes, Ashton Hogriff, Grant Closser, Caleb Rowland, Jackson Scritch, Taylen Bonnet, Joe Bogue, Jaden Then, Drew Birds, Garrett Klusner, Bradley Brocious, Owen Habel, Ben Wernemont, Quentin Nauman, Caden Begley, Grant Demmer, Gabe Wessels, Sam Crapful, Hunter Quagliano, Caden Wohlers, Jack Lansing, Jimmy Hoover, Coy Messer, Leo Hammerend, Justin Kurt, Donovan Tran, John Lemke, Luke Boyle, Rory Higgins, Bo Jasper, Ben Klusner, Brady Colt, Tristan Lundsman, Caleb Smith, Blaine Telford, Michael Rankin, Jake LaCrone, Charlie Zimmerman, Colt Pace, Jack Bogue, Zach Lucas, Simon McDermott, Drew Horsfall, and Jared Shanbeck. The outlook for the Bobcats, they return a ton of talent from last year's state meet and enter the 2024 outdoor season with eyes on contending for the 3A team title in Des Moines. Hogriff won two individual medals last year at state, while Nauman claimed bronze in the 800 as a freshman. Western Dubuque brings back the majority of its athletes from seven different relay teams that won three bronze, three silver, and one gold medal on the Blue Oval last season. The Bobcats will be increasingly balanced across all events, and a large group of underclassmen will only add to the depth. Western Dubuque took second as a team last year at state. Look for the Bobcats to contend for the top spot this year. And in our final minutes here, let's take a look at what's on TV today in the sports world. In golf, the PGA Tour live from the Masters at 8 a.m. on the Golf Channel and 6 p.m. on the Golf Channel. National League Hockey, Capitals at Red Wings at 6 p.m. on ESPN and the Wild at the Avalanche at 8:30 on ESPN. College baseball, Florida at Florida State at 6 p.m. on ESPN2. College softball, Clemson at South Carolina, 6 p.m. on ESPNU. NBA basketball, Celtics at Bucks, 6:30 p.m. on True TV and TNT. Knicks at Bulls at 7 p.m. on NBC Sports Channel Chicago. And the Warriors at the Lakers at 9 p.m. on True TV and TNT. Major League Baseball, White Sox at Guardians at 5:10 p.m. on the NBC Sports Channel Chicago. The Brewers at the Reds at 5:40 p.m. on BSWI, which I believe is Bally Sports Wisconsin. Philadelphia Phillies at the St. Louis Cardinals at 6:45 on Bally Sports Midwest. And the Cubs at the Padres at 9 p.m. on TBS and Marquee. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.